introduction. This year, as many of us probably know, marks the 25th yahrzeit of HaRav Yosef Dov ben HaRav Moshe Soloveitchik, better known to many of us as the Rav. As a child of a father who was profoundly impacted by the instruction, by the teaching, and by the incredible life that the Rav lived, I hope that this Pesach I would be able to share some meaningful insights from the Rav that would elevate our Pesach and make us think a little bit differently about how we approach the Seder this year. What we're going to learn through today together is not all from one source. It is a number of selections from the Rav's writings, probably 10 to 15 different passages from different places, and it is stuff that I have collected from over the years reading all of the many beautiful works that the Rav himself wrote or the Rav said and then were transcribed later on. So with that introduction in mind, let us now begin. Jewish tradition, as we know, puts a tremendous emphasis on the communal observance, on communal commemoration, sometimes communal celebration of different times throughout the year. And the calendar is a very important thing to Jewish tradition. As we know, the very first mitzvah that the Jewish people were given on their liberation from Mitzrayim was HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim, which means we were given the mitzvah, we were given the obligation to dictate the calendar and to figure out exactly when the various chagim, when all the Yamim Tovim would fall out on any given year. So the calendar and time has an extremely significant role in the Jewish religion and in Jewish tradition as we know it. The Rav writes in his book Halachic Man, which is such an important work for those who study the works of the Rav. This was one of the most important works that he had published in his lifetime. So he writes in the book Halachic Man about his perspective on time. That is the first entry on the source sheet where we read as follows. The experience of Halachic Man is not circumscribed by his own individual past, but it transcends this limited realm and enters the domain of eternity. The Jewish people's all-embracing collective consciousness of time, the sages of the tradition, the Second Temple era, the age of classical prophecy, the exodus from Egypt, the lives of the patriarchs, the creation itself, they are all, says the Rav, an integral part of the eye awareness of Halachic Man. So when I come to an experience, when I engage in any religious ritual, in any moment of my life that I'm involved in, the Rav says you're coming not just at that moment in time that you are happen to be experiencing, but the Rav suggests you are coming with a whole history that stands behind you and a future that stands before you. Let's continue. Similarly, Halachic Man's future does not terminate with the end of his own individual future at the moment of death, but it extends into the future of the people as a whole, the people who yearn for the coming of Mashiach and the kingdom of God. As we know, on the second night of Pesach, we begin what we refer to as the Count of Sfiras HaOmer, and that ushers us into the celebration of Shavuos, 49 days later. So once again, when we talk about the counting from Pesach until Shavuos that we're going to fulfill this year as well, the Rav writes in a different selection, in a different book, you look at the next entry, the Rav tells us what does time mean to him? What is that count supposed to signify to all of us? What is the relevance, what is the significance of the fact that we count 49 days? And the Rav points out that not only do we count 49 days leading us into Shavuos, but if you look through Chumash, you will find that so often we have the Torah instructs us to be involved and engaged in accounting. Why is that? So the Rav writes as follows. The Jew counts. He counts days, he counts weeks, he counts years, and he counts Shmitos, sabbatical years. He counts 6 days of every week, and then he celebrates Shabbos. He counts 49 days as well as 7 weeks during the Omer period, and concludes his count with the observance of Shavuos. He counts 7 years and keeps Shemitah. He counts 49 years and 7 Shemitos and then proclaims the Yovel. Moreover, the Rav writes, cleansing and purging, when we talk about Tumah and Tahara, they are bound up with counting as well. The Torah frequently mentions that the defiled person is to count 7 days of cleansing and only on the seventh is he or she permitted to immerse in water. Mourning too, God forbid, is also an act of counting. The mourner counts 7 or 30 days. The bottom line is, counting plays a major role in our religious life. And the Rav spends about 10 pages trying to develop this theme and explain why that is the case. So just to give you the cliff notes, the Rav basically explains that the reason why is because when one keeps account of anything, when I say that today is day 23, it means I understand and I recognize that yesterday was 22 and that tomorrow is 24. Counting, by its very nature, understands that a person recognizes there's something that came before and there is something that will come after. And that, says the Rav, is what Jewish life is all about. It's about understanding that time is not just in a vacuum, that we don't just experience the moment that's in front of us, but that whenever we have experiences throughout life, it is always an opportunity for us to appreciate all that came before us and all that will continue to come after us. And therefore, the Rav suggests this is why there's such an emphasis throughout the Torah in many different contexts that we need to keep account of something. All of that just to remind us that that is what Jewish life, that is what Jewish tradition is meant to be all about. And he continues, Judaism has formulated a unique philosophy of time. We ought to experience time simultaneously in its two dimensions, as recollection and as anticipation, as a review and as meditation, as a quest and a search. Time is the experiential memory that reaches out for the as yet not real future. Go to the next side of the page. In consequence, the Jew is aware experientially of the past and committed to the future, which is a reality to him. To exist as a Jew means to be at a juncture of the past and of the future, of that which is no longer real and that which is not yet real. And our mission, he writes, is to live in both dimensions. A person's job in life is to understand that we have to appreciate both of those dimensions, the entire spectrum of Jewish history. Not only that which has happened, but that which will happen in the future as well. Rav Soloveitchik argues that our communal understanding of time is really meant to emphasize our firm commitment to the Mesorah that we have, to the past that we come from, and to the future that we pledge to be strong, that we pledge to continue to give on the messages and the lessons of what all of our Mesorah means to us. And the Rav writes that that really is the definition of a bris, of a covenant. What does it mean when we say so often in Chumash that we are engaged in an everlasting and an eternal covenant with God? How is it possible that Avraham Avinu makes a covenant with the Ribono Shel Olam, that Yaakov Avinu makes, that Moshe Rabbeinu makes? How can that be? If God is here in an eternal and an everlasting way, and I am just here for a short span of time throughout the incredible vast history that we've been through, how can I make a covenant with God? What does that mean? Well, suggest thereof, a covenant, a bris, means that you are not only committing yourself, but you commit all that will come after you as well to whatever it is that you are agreeing to. That's what a covenant means with Avraham Avinu. That's what a bris means. And therefore, suggests the Rav, this is always what the bris has meant to all generations that have come before us. I'll just read to you two snippets that he says here. What is a covenant if not the unity of all time dimensions? That's the definition of what a bris means. An involvement in the bygone and the commitment to the as yet non-existent confederacy of generations, events and situations from the dawn of historical time until the end of the historical cycle. That, says the Rav, is what a covenant means. And therefore he says, how strange is it that you look through Chumash and every time the Ribono Shel Olam enters into a covenant with the Jewish people, with Avraham Avinu, with Yaakov Avinu, with Moshe Rabbeinu, and everyone else, you will find that it is always revolving around food. Always revolves around a meal. Avraham Avinu makes a covenant with God, Bris Bein HaBesarim. What is that about? That's the way that you interact with God. That is the way that you give Him your promise and your pledge. You sit around and you offer animals. Is that really what gives significance to the moment that you're about to engage with God in? And he says, historically, he goes through a whole description of history where you find that every single time there was a covenant that was made between one of our great leaders in history and God Himself, you will find that it was always revolving around a meal. The Rav suggests this is what the night of the Seder is as well. The night of the Seder is our opportunity not only to just sit around and recall and relive the incredible memories that we have of our nation's past, of our history and all the difficulties, but he says it is also an opportunity for us to anticipate the glorious future of the generations that will come in our Jewish community. And therefore, says the Rav, this in turn is our covenant. When we come to the night of the Seder, it is our expression of reaffirming the bris, the covenant that we have made throughout all the millennia with God. We push it forward and we pledge that that is what we will do on the night of the Seder as well. Traditionally, you will find, it's not unusual, that you will have a multi-generational Seder. You will have grandparents and sometimes great-grandparents sitting together around one table, all sharing the experiences of thousands of years ago and talking about the future that they look forward to. That is what the Seder is all about. It is about renewing our commitment, not only to what was, not only to remind ourselves of those vivid memories of what took place so many years ago, but also to pledge and to promise to the next generation that we will push this covenant forward and it will be something meaningful until the days when the Geula HaAsida will come as well. Yes. I believe it is a little bit strange when you think about that, that when you have the incredibly significant and symbolic evening that the Seder is supposed to be, when you have all of these covenants that the Torah describes and that the Rav goes through in detail, isn't it strange that all of these critical messages that we're supposed to transmit, that we're supposed to give over on the night of the Seder, are given over around food? It's a strange phenomenon that that is always historically what it has been. Is that really the way that we should transmit to our children a sense of freedom, a sense of liberation, a sense of being able to do what it is that we want, and we're no longer under the servitude of Paro and of Mitzrayim? Why is that the context that we choose? This is such an important evening, and there are so many critical messages that need to be given over. Why is it that we choose to do it around four cups of wine, and around eating and drinking in the times of the Gemara, in the times of the Chumash? Obviously, they did it with the Karban Pesach, sitting and eating a steak on the night of the Seder. Why is that something that has become the choice way to celebrate this incredible moment historically in which we transmit the most important values of our tradition to our children? And for this, I would like to turn our attention to another passage of the Rav, which is so beautiful. He doesn't address this question directly, but I think the point that he brings out is something that is very relevant to that which we are presenting. So you look on page 2, halfway down the page. The transition from slavery to freedom is very critical. Here, the Rav is going to take us back in history to that very first evening of redemption. He's going to take us back into Mitzrayim to understand what exactly took place when the Jewish people went free. The masters who exploited, who tortured, and who humiliated find themselves suddenly at the mercy of the slaves for whom they showed no concern and displayed no human emotion. The natural reaction of the slave who is suddenly freed is to get his satisfaction, to avenge himself on the tyrant who murdered his baby, who assaulted and disgraced his daughter, who mercilessly beat him for any minor infraction of the nonsensical and sadistic rule. It is usually a bloody, ruthless, and vengeful transition. Fear of a slave upheaval haunted all the tyrants of antiquity, as well as those of modern times. I did a quick Google search last night for slave uprising. Wikipedia, you should see how many things came up. And not only is it an entry on Wikipedia, but it's also split up by country and continent, because there were hundreds, tens in every single continent all over the world. This is what happens. When you have an uprising, when you have a coup, there's complete chaos and lawlessness. And the Rav writes, rebellion by slaves meant total destruction. Historically, that has been what it always has meant. I was telling this insight over yesterday on the phone to Rav Asher Weiss, and I shared with him how I was very profoundly impacted by this point. And he made mention to me that how unusual it was in modern history that Nelson Mandela, who was put away in solitary confinement in, where was it, Robben Island? What? And he was an anti-apartheid, and after all of that oppression, after the horrible conditions that he was in, you don't find that the country fell apart after he was released. It's an amazing phenomenon, and the reason why he became famous for that is because that's very unusual, because that's never what happens. When you have a people that is so horribly oppressed, you never find that when they get liberated, when they get out and they are no longer under the harrowing shackles of slavery, you don't find that they just build a democracy and everything is peaceful. It's unusual, and that's why that was so historic. You go back here, rebellion by slaves always has meant a total destruction. History records many bloody and ruthless insurrections of slaves against their masters. Ancient Rome experienced twice or thrice a grim confrontation with slaves who had set themselves free. European history knows of the peasants' rebellion in medieval Germany and of the bloody Cossack revolt in Ukraine. The stories about the cruelty of the rebels are blood-chilling. They were eager to settle a long account of cruelty, and horrific massacres were typical. Turn the page. Did anything of that kind happen? Think about this insight. Just consider it. I never thought about it, but the Rav points out something that is just so obvious. Did anything of that kind happen on the night of the Exodus? Just consider the point. 600,000 slaves were liberated. Paro came to Goshen to plead with Moshe Rabbeinu. The Egyptians were hysterical, moaning and crying. There was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. The Jews were now the masters, and the Egyptians were now the subordinates. The oppressors were at the mercy of their former slaves. And asked the Rav, were Egyptian babies taken out of the embrace of their mothers and thrown into the Nile, as the babies of the slaves had been murdered just a short while before? Did the Hebrews beat up the taskmasters who had just several days ago tortured them mercilessly? Did the liberated slaves set fire to the exclusive neighborhoods of their former overlords? Did the teenagers smash at least the window panes of the offices where their taskmasters used to assemble and plan restrictive and sadistic edicts? Nothing of the sort. Not one person was hurt, and not one house was destroyed. Amazing. The liberated slaves had the courage to withdraw, to defy the natural call of the blood. What did the Jews do in the hour of their freedom? Instead of swarming the streets of Goshen, they were locked up in their houses, eating the Korban Pesach and reciting the Hallel. And this, writes the Rav, is unique in the history of revolutions. There has never been such a thing. There has never been such a phenomenon. The way the Jewish people responded, the way they reacted. Would we blame the Jews, he continues, if they had engaged in a few acts of vandalism or even murder on the night of the 15th of Nisan? Killing a few of the taskmasters who had thrown their babies into the Nile? The Jews, at the command of God, said no. They defied themselves and refused to gratify the basic need of the human being, the need for revenge. But by defeating themselves, they also won the greatest of all victories. And what was that? They became free. This is exactly what we commemorate and what we celebrate on the night of the Seder, which in essence means, what does it mean to be a free man? What does it mean to be a free nation? The definition of being free is that a person has the ability to submit themselves to the natural, to the most basic, to the most instinctive needs that any human being would feel, and to learn to live a life which integrates spirituality with all of the physical that we experience. Yes, we all have natural tendencies. We all have natural desires. We all have natural inclinations. That is part of the human condition. That is who we are. Being free means the person has the ability to choose how they are going to respond. On the night of our liberation from Mitzrayim, we chose to respond to a higher calling. We chose to respond and to defy any natural reaction that a normal human being would have when they went through the experience that we had. And that is the opportunity that every free man and woman has since we came out of Mitzrayim, to elevate and to consecrate every moment of life that we now experience. We are no longer subject to the impulses that a human being always feels when they are faced with the responses that a human being is supposed to react with experiences in life that they are faced with. So somebody might correctly ask, so you're correct that we were no longer enslaved to Mitzrayim, but now we feel the shackles of God Himself, should we say. Correct? So that's not called being free. And the Rav, in another one of his books, I'm sorry, we're doing so much of the Rav, I don't have to apologize. I think the Rav is amazing. And I feel bad that we don't study his thought enough, because I think all of his insights were very powerful. So the Rav writes for an example here. It's in the middle of a long essay that he talks about, what does ethical man mean? And he says here, just to try and accentuate this point a little bit, he says, take hunger for example. Think about when you're hungry. The hunger emotion was never conceived by man as a specific duty. Nobody told you to be hungry, correct? It's instinctive. If you don't eat, you're going to be hungry. He is driven by it and is aware of the must in the sense of not being able to act differently. When I'm hungry, I must eat. When I have this feeling, I must respond in this way. However, there is no imperative component involved. The natural must excludes freedom. That means you're not a free person. When you have the need to respond to your physical calling, that means you are in shackles. It means you are not free. While the ethical must guarantees free choice, which means when we have the ability to follow the edicts that the Torah spells out for us, that is the definition of true freedom, because a person has the right to decide whether they want to live life with that moral code, with that higher order, or not. No bolt of lightning is going to come down and strike a person if they choose not to. That's what it means to be free. There is no instinctive push that makes us make that choice. There's an amazing pasuk where Moshe Rabbeinu speaks in Sefer Devarim. And he says, "V'hayaki v'yacha Hashem el ha'aretz." It will be the time when God will finally bring you into the land. Moshe Rabbeinu, as we know, is leading the Jewish people through the desert. And you will find there, says Moshe Rabbeinu, "Arim gedolos v'tovos asher lo banisa." You will find houses that you did not build, but beautiful homes that will be left there for you to enjoy. Batim aleim kol tuv. There will be homes that will be overloaded with everything that you can ever ask for. Asher lo meleisa, and you didn't even pay to fill them up with all those goods. Ve'achalta v'savata, and you will eat, and you will have festivities, and you will enjoy all of the riches that the land of Israel will provide you with. The very next pasuk. Hishamer lecha. Moshe Rabbeinu warns us. Hishamer lecha, be careful. Pentishkachas Hashem asher hotziacha me'eretz Mitzrayim mi'beis avadim. Maybe you will forget on that occasion about the God who took you out of Egypt. Why is that the very next pasuk? Why is that the next sentence in Moshe Rabbeinu's speech? He says you're going to come to a great land and you're going to love it and there's going to be everything you can ever imagine. But be careful. Don't forget about God who took you out of Egypt. Why is that relevant to the conversation? And the answer is very simple. Because if you get so involved in all of the luxuries, in all of the impulses that normal human beings involve themselves in, you forget what it means to be a free person. When you're so engaged in indulging in everything that will make you happy, that will make you excited, you no longer have that perspective. You no longer have that ability to actually be free. And therefore, perhaps Moshe Rabbeinu here says, don't forget about God, not just forgetting about God, don't forget about God who took you out of Egypt and who taught you what it means to be free, and who made you understand that you have the ability in life to rise above the natural impulses that all human beings face. That's what freedom means. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu warns us of, because it's so easy to forget the fact that we are all a free people and what freedom actually means for us. You ever think about the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos? Mishnah tells us very famously, "Eizehu chacham halomed mikol adam." Who is the wise man, the one who learns from everybody? "Eizehu gibar hakovesh es yitzro." "Eizehu ashir hasameach bechalko." "Eizehu mechubad hamechabed es habrios." You ever thought about how strange it is? We've all learned this Mishnah. We've all heard this teaching. But it really doesn't make sense. If I would ask you without knowing this Mishnah, who is the wise man? I would have said, go look around the world and see how many people are listening to you, how many people are influenced by your teaching, how many people are reading the books that you publish or the articles that you write. That's the man who is wise, the person who has the ability to transmit knowledge to others. I would have said, who is the one who is wealthy? Well, let's see, how many business dealings do you have? How much money have you accumulated? How much have you been involved in all that goes on in the community, in philanthropy? Shouldn't that be the defining bar, the defining characteristic of who is wealthy? Who is mechubad? I would have naturally said, it is the person who everybody in the community looks up to, who everybody in the community is running to honor, is running to give things to, is running to hold on a high pedestal. That is the mechubad. But the Mishnah says no. The Mishnah tells us that by being a true free person, ein lecha ben chorin ala misha osik batorah, The Torah values give us the opportunity to live on a higher order and to be rich without having money, without being bound to the need for money. That is freedom. The Torah gives us the ability to be mechubadim without needing other people to do anything for us. We are free. We don't have to be bound to the needs and to the wants and to the fanfare of other people in order to be living the wonderful life that we want to live. That's what freedom means. And here the Mishnah points out to us that you can be the rich man without having any money. You can be strong without having any muscles or without having any power. You can be someone who is honored without being honored at all the dinners. You can be an honorary person just by the nature of acting in the way that you do. Because life gives us the opportunity to be free. That is what we learned on the night of the Seder. This is what we learned on the night when we came out of Mitzrayim, that being free does not mean what everybody thinks it means. Being free does not mean that we go and we take revenge. Being free does not mean that we do what any human being would have done should they have been let free after all the terrible oppression in Egypt. Being free to us means living life with a higher set of moral and ethical values and being able to infuse every moment of our lives with the values that God instructs us and suggests that we live life by. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he goes down to take the Jews out of Egypt, God tells him the following, V'zelecha ha'oz ki anochi shalachticha. How will you know that I was the one, God says, that was involved in all of the great miracles and everything that takes place in Mitzrayim? God says, when all of this comes to an end, B'hotziacha es ha'ami Mitzrayim, tavdun es ha'elokim al ha'har hazeh. The objective, the purpose of all of that took place in Mitzrayim, the objective of all of that was Tavdun es ha'elokim al ha'har hazeh. You will come to a time when you will serve God on this mountain. That was the point of Yetzias Mitzrayim, was to get us to the acceptance of the Torah. Now, if you look carefully at that, at the description of that momentous encounter that we had with God Himself, it was an amazing experience. But the Gemara Masechet Shabbos tells us that we had an immediate acceptance of the Torah, Na'aseh v'nishma. And when you think about how paradoxical that is, how strange it is, who would ever do such a thing? Imagine you come into a doctor's office and they put a few pieces of paper in front of you and you just sign it without reading. Imagine a lawyer calls you one day and says, I'd like you to sign the dotted line right here. I don't want you to read anything. Just sign it. You can trust me. I know you for a long time. Who would ever do such a thing? Who would ever sign something without knowing the terms and conditions of what it is that they're agreeing to? And yet we came with unconditional faith and we signed up to the terms that we didn't even understand yet, that we didn't even know. This is what Na'aseh v'nishma mean. We acted almost like angels. Angels don't have free choice. Angels just do whatever God asked them to do. That is the way we responded on the occasion of Yetzias Mitzrayim, which leads to a very strange question. Because the Medrash expands on the story of Kabbalah Satorah, and the Medrash says that on this occasion, when we as human beings elevated ourselves to act like angels do, the angels themselves began to argue with God. And the angels said, Tein hodcha ala shamayim. Why are you giving over your Torah to this lowly people on earth? Why wouldn't you keep it up here with us in heaven? And they began to appeal, they began to argue with God that we are undeserving and we are unworthy. Isn't that strange? The one time in history that we acted like them, the one time in history that we acted like angels do, is the time in history when they say we are subpar and we are undeserving. How do you understand that story? And I believe the answer is very simple. Because the angels understood that the significance and the value of the Torah and everything it represents is only when all that it stands for is able to be applied and operated in the human life, when all of the values that it stands for are able to be infused and elevate the lives that we all live. So the angel said to God, if we now have a people that are subscribing themselves to live like angels and to no longer live the human life, of what value is the Torah to them? Why should we give it to them? May as well keep it upstairs. Why send it down to the world if the people you're giving it to are not interested in being human beings anymore, but they want to be celestial beings? They want to be malachim. The greatest significance of the Torah is that the Torah understands that we all live human lives, that we all have challenges, that we all have issues that we face, but the Torah gives us the opportunity to elevate ourselves and to live by a higher moral code and value system. That is what freedom means. This is why the objective of leaving Mitzrayim, of all that God performed for us on that occasion, was Tavdun es ha'elokim ala harazeh. That's what it was all about. Because that's what freedom really means. You have the freedom to choose to live life on a higher plane. Which is not something most ordinary human beings have the chance to do. If you look in Parshas Mishpatim, at the very end of the story of Kabbalah Satorah, the Torah tells us, Ve'anshei kodesh tiyun li. God says that He wants us to be Anshei kodesh. He wants us to be holy people. The Kutzker Rebbe points out that God went out of His way after this unbelievable experience of Kabbalah Satorah, God went out of His way to give us one reminder when it was coming to a close. I don't want you to be Malachei kodesh. My expectation of you as Jews is not that you're going to live on a level of angels. It's not that you're going to stay on the top of the mountain like you were, communicating with God throughout life, always being on Har Sinai and having Moshe Rabbeinu in your life. That is not what I expect of you. God reminds us He wants us to be Anshei Kodesh. He wants us to be ordinary human beings who participate, who engage, and who are a part and a contributing factor to every single thing that goes on in this world, and to face every challenge that the world puts at us, but to enrich and to elevate all of it by the values of the Torah that God has just given us. And this is why when Kabbalah Satorah comes to a close, the one and only message God gives over to us is, don't ever forget. Anshei kodesh tiyun li. This is what I want. This is why I made you free, because I gave you the opportunity to choose how you are going to live life. Are you going to live life like everybody else, guided by the basic instincts and impulses that human beings live by? Or do you have the opportunity to rise above that and to choose how you are going to respond? Back to our original question. You wonder why we sit on the night of the Seder. And the way that we commemorate, all that we want to transmit to our children is by sitting around, eating and drinking. You know what the answer is? That is the greatest way to express our freedom. There is a way in which we eat. There is a way in which we respond to tragedy. There is a way in which we react. That is what took place on the very first time when we were liberated in Mitzrayim. There was a reason not a single Jew left their homes that night. Not a single Jew was involved in vandalism, in murder, in spilling blood, as justified as it may have been. As much as the precedent of history always was that that is the natural response and reaction of a person, and you wouldn't even be held accountable had you done such a thing. That's expected. But yet that is not the way the Jew lives life. The Jew lives life understanding that we have the ability to choose how we will respond. We will not be instinctive. We will rise above it. So the Rav writes, I think we're on page number 4. Okay. Halfway down the page. The halacha does not aspire to a heavenly transcendence, nor does it seek to soar upon the wings of some abstract, mysterious spirituality. It fixes its gaze upon concrete, empirical reality and does not allow its attention to be diverted from it. The Rav writes, on the contrary, skip 2 lines, he brings down eternity into the midst of time. This is what we do as Jews. We bring God's eternal messages into the time that we live, into the experiences that we have. Even when halachic man enters the synagogue or the study house, he does not leave his this worldly life behind. His prayer is replete with requests regarding bodily needs, healing, prosperity, political freedom, and a good and peaceful life. Isn't that unusual? You have nothing better to talk to God about than the fact that you need a parnasa? Is that what you're going to bother Him with? You got fired from your job? You need a new position? We have all kinds of things that bother us. Very basic humanistic needs. That's what we spend Shemona Esrei discussing with God? The answer is absolutely. That's exactly what God has an interest in us doing in our lives. He wants us to live the complete experience of life, appreciating all that the physical life has to offer us, but elevating it all and doing it in a way that is in sync with the values that God Himself transmitted to us. See what many religions have done to this world on account of their yearning to break through the bounds of concrete reality and escape to the sphere of eternity. They have been so intoxicated by their dreams of the exalted supernal existence that they have failed to hear the cries, the sighs of the orphans, the groans of the destitute. Had they not desired to unite with infinity and to merge with transcendence, then they might have been able to do something to aid the widow and the orphan, to save the oppressed from the hand of the oppressor. There is nothing, writes the Rav, that is so physically and spiritually destructive as diverting one's attention from this world. And by contrast, how courageous is halachic man who does not flee from this world, who does not seek to escape to some pure and supernal realm. Halachic man craves to bring down the divine presence and holiness into the midst of space and time, into the midst of the finite and earthly experience. This is what our lives are all about. The Rav points out in another place that if you look through halacha carefully, you will notice that the halacha seems to have something to say about every single aspect of this earth. And the Rav writes as follows, that the halacha is interested in all sociological creations, the state, the society, the relationship of individuals within the communal context. He says the halacha also deals with laws of business, torts, neighbors, plaintiffs and defendants, creditors and debtors, partners, agents, workers, artisans, baileys, family life, marriage, divorce, chalitza, sota, conjugal refusal, the respective rights, obligations, duties of a husband to a wife. Everything is dealt with in the halacha. Why? Because that's exactly what God wants us to do with His Torah. That's why He made us free, to be involved in all of the above, to do everything that was just mentioned, but to do it based on the principles that He gave over to us. The Rev writes that holiness always traditionally has been created by man himself. You ever wonder? Come to a Beis HaMikdash, you offer a karban on the Mizbeach, all of a sudden it's holy? If you take it out of the Beis HaMikdash, it is defiled? How did that happen? Because we took the physical and we elevated it. That is the ability that we have at every moment, at every experience, at every juncture throughout our lives. The Rambam writes that the great significance, the holiness that was infused into the city of Yerushalayim happened because the Jewish people infused it with that sanctity, with that holiness. Because we surrounded the cities and we went and we offered karbanos and we did things, physical activities that made the place holy. That is what our lives give us the opportunity to do. We're going to close. I know we said a lot and there's a lot to internalize. But let's just close with one final paragraph. Turn to the last entry that we have. Page number 6. On the bottom of the page. Choice is granted to every human being. What it means to be free is that we have the choice. And the Rav writes, if a man wants to follow the good path and be good, the choice is his. If he wants to follow the evil path and be wicked, the choice is also his. Let it not occur to your mind that God decrees at the birth of a person that he shall be good or evil. A notion expressed by multitude of ignorant Jewish individuals. It is not so. Every human being is fit to become as righteous as Moshe or as wicked as Yeravam, wise or foolish, merciful or cruel, and so on with all the other traits. Indeed, the Rav ends off, man's entire spiritual existence is enhanced by his unique privilege to create himself and to make himself into a free man. That's what it means to be free. When we experience freedom on the night of the Seder, and we relive this unbelievable story that took place thousands of years ago, we remind ourselves, number one, that we are reaffirming our commitment to the bris, to the covenant of Jews, and what that's meant to our ancestors, and what it needs to mean to our children and grandchildren. What it means to be engaged in a covenant is, as we started, that you are here for all eternity. That the moment that you're experiencing now is not just the one that's before me, but it has the backdrop of all of Jewish history, and it also has the future of Jewish history. That is a pledge that we need to put forth on the night of the Seder, that we will continue to impress the values that God has given us onto our children, onto all of those that will come in future generations. That's what the night of the Seder is meant to accomplish. And the basic message that we need to give over is, what is the defining characteristic of freedom? Think about what took place on that very night of redemption, on that very first night of liberation. What did the Jews do? How did they respond? How did they react? The answer is, they acted as free people. They overcame their natural impulses. That's what a free person means. That we all have humanistic needs. We all have things that we like to be involved in that are just basic to any human being. But there's a way in which we can choose to face all of it. There's a way in which we can have the opportunity of choice in everything that we do to live life in an elevated plateau, to live life in a way that is so enriching, that is so inspiring, that is so elevating, that is so uplifting. That is the way we can choose to spend every waking moment of our lives, and that is the reason ultimately why God made us into a free people. I wish everyone